Amen. All right. The writer of Hebrews is got several or has several topics that he's trying to get across. But he's dealing with a problem, and we need to always kind of keep that problem in mind. And chapter 3 is going to really hit hard on what that problem is, and that is their tendency to fall back, to fall away. And he is trying to make arguments to this group of Jewish Christians that lets them understand, based on their Old Testament background, which they knew and believed, what it is that about Christ and about this new law that makes it worthy of them really hanging on to. And last week in chapter 2, we dealt with the whole concept of when Jesus came to this earth, the fact that he was human and that he died and he didn't necessarily meet the Jewish expectations of what Messiah should be, did not disqualify him from being the Messiah, but in fact, he comes to the conclusion it was necessary that Christ come and live like us, because in that sense, it perfected him. And we talked a little bit about the word perfect, being complete, in order for him to serve in what role? What's the role that he's been heading for here, and he's going to emphasize over and over again in Hebrews? High priest. Now, there's multiple roles, though, that Jesus is going to serve in. And in order for them to understand the real position of Christ, he's got to get a couple of things across here that chapter 3 is, we have to watch the wording very closely. So take a look at chapter 3, verse 1. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. Now, he's used two words when he says, I want you to think about Jesus, but I want you to think about him in two roles. What's the first one that he lists? Apostle. And then the second one is high priest. Now, these aren't just random words that he's picked. And we have to be really careful as we go through this chapter of the wording. Who do we normally think of as the apostles? What is an apostle? Okay, it's one that's sent. It's a messenger. And Paul also uses another term when he talks about their work as apostles. He said that they were ambassadors for Christ, right? So what's an ambassador do? It speaks on behalf of somebody else. It represents someone. You know, in our world today, the head of a country picks ambassadors to go to these overseas posts, right? And they want to pick people. Okay, well, a lot of times it's just political. But what they really want to do is they want to pick someone that will represent their views, right? Now, it was especially important when we didn't have the communication that we've got today. You know, when it was weeks before a letter would get to some place, then that apostle, that ambassador, was the representative. So in what role is Jesus sent, and who does he represent in his role as an apostle? He's sent from God. And who's he representing then? God. To whom? Whole world, right? Now, think of the role of high priest. What was the role of the high priest? Who did they represent? The people. To whom? To God. You see that? He's got Jesus in both roles here. As representing us to God, and representing God to us. And this isn't the first time he said that. Remember in the Hebrews 1, in the opening three verses there, what did he say about Christ? He is the exact representation of his glory, right? So in looking at Christ, we can understand God. And Christ then, and his role as high priest, will help present us and represent us before God. So he says, consider him in these two roles. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. Now, where'd Moses come from? This seems like sort of out of left field here, right? All of a sudden we've got Moses. Okay, Moses was the Old Testament lawgiver, right? And Moses was the one that, above all the others in Jewish faith and writings and in their beliefs, was venerated as the lawgiver. In fact, he was so tightly coupled with the Torah that you couldn't speak evil of Moses because then you were speaking evil of God's word. And vice versa, if you were putting down God's law or disrespecting the Torah, then you were equivalently doing that to Moses because they were so tightly coupled. Now, he's got to show something here. Moses is so respected that how are we going to look at Christ then? Well, we've got to understand that Christ is going to be in a position where in relation to Moses? Higher than Moses. But we don't want to put Moses down. I mean, if you want to show somebody's better than somebody else, there's two ways to do it. Now, in sports teams, normally what do? If you want to show that your team's better than the other team? Yeah, exactly. You stomp on the other guys, right? You put them down. He's not going to do that with Moses. In fact, what does he call Moses here when he just first brings him out? Faithful. And he applies that same word to Christ. So he's putting Moses and Christ both in the category of faithful servants of God. Now, I think this is deliberate. If these people, as I think they were, Jewish Christians who really understood the old law, then they do have this underlying respect for Moses. And it's not going to do to put Moses down. And in fact, that's not the place. Even God spoke well of Moses, right? How is Moses known? As the one who spoke face to face with God, unlike any other. So, he's faithful. But now again, we have to look at the wording. I need a reader, please, to read verses 3 through 6, please. 3 through 6. Who's got that for me? Benjamin, go ahead.
For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses. By just so much as the builder of the house is more honored than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son for his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence in the hope of our hope from his people.
Okay, in these verses, he's got this theme running through, and what word do you see almost in every verse? Okay, you see the faithful, you see house, okay? And so we got to talk about this whole house thing. He's counted worthy of more glory than Moses. In what way? Just like the builder of a house, right, is worthy of more honor than the house itself. Now, he's not talking about your normal run-of-the-mill just house you drive down the street. Nobody considers who built it or who architected it. I liken it to class this morning to, you know, if you're looking, you're going and walking up the hill in Austria and you see Neuschwanstein on the hill. It's an amazing sight. It's a really cool castle. And if you've ever seen Cinderella's castle in Orlando, that was patterned after that. But seeing the real one there is pretty amazing. But the first thing you got to think of when you look at that is Ludwig helped design this thing. Okay? Now, when you hear of somebody like Frank Lloyd Wright, okay, he's got houses all over that are landmarks in our country. And when people see it, what do they say? Oh, that's a really cool house. Well, if they don't know any better, that's what they say. But if somebody who understands or knows the background of it, they go, oh, that's a Frank Lloyd Wright house, right? Why? Because even though the house is neat, the real thing is the one who thought it up, the one who envisioned the whole thing and had it put together. Now, how does he relate that to Moses here? He says, well, every house is built by someone. Who built our house? And he's going to go down in a minute and say who that is. Who built everything? God did. Okay, that's almost like one of those questions that you always tell your kids when they're at the table, right? When they ask you why, if you don't know, you just the reason is because God made it that way. But here, he's got this whole concept of the house, and he says two things here. Notice in verse 5 and verse 6, he uses two different prepositions when he talks about the position of Moses and the position of Christ, right? Did you notice that? Yeah. What was the position he said about Moses? He was a servant in the house. Can that be a position of honor and position of respect? Certainly. But what was Christ? He was the son over the house. That puts them in their proper relation without taking anything away from Moses. And so he says, you've got to consider this. This is the position that Jesus takes, a faithful son over the house. Now, whose house we are? Who's the we here? All the Christians that he's writing to, right? Whose house we are, we're that house. Oh, he's got a qualifying statement there, right? What's the qualifying statement? Whose house we are if we hold fast. If we hold fast. So, there's some work to do to make sure that we stay in this house. And that's what he now has to address. Whose house we are if we hold fast. And now he's going to pull out his favorite book of the Old Testament, Psalms, and read through some of this for them. And he says, therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, and he quotes from the Septuagint version of Psalms 95. So somebody please read for me verses 7 through 11, please. You got it, Mark? Okay. Now we have to understand the context of this. It's a psalm of David. In fact, he says in a couple of, over in chapter 4, you know, David reminds us of this. And he's going to quote little bits of this psalm, especially the whole today business, multiple times here in the rest of chapter 3 and 4. But what event is David writing about in this psalm? Or events? And in specific, there's two of them. There's the one in Exodus 17, where they're coming out of the land of Egypt, and they're across the Red Sea, and by that point in their history, had they seen anything that might give them the impression that God was an all-powerful God? Okay, what all had they seen by this point in time? All the plagues in Egypt, right? What else? Pillars of fire? I think, the manna, they had the manna by this point. The Red Sea, I think if I'd have wanted to remember anything, that would have been pretty graphic, to be up against a body of water you could not cross, the Egyptian army right at your heels, and what happens? It splits open, they walk through, and it just so happens that when they get finished and the Egyptians come in, it wipes out the Egyptian army. Now, there's a coincidence for you, right? And so now they're in the wilderness, and they're short of water. Now, water is a necessity of life. Anybody who's been out in a hot Texas day understands being short of water, right? And so what did they do? They grumbled. I love the comparison here between this generation and the generation as they're ready to go into the land. There are three instances where they're short of water. This one and the next one we're going to talk about. So this particular one in Exodus, what happened? Well, God told Moses, go up, talk to the people. He says, how long are these people not going to believe me that I'm going to take care of them? God, that was showing what? By the fact that they were grumbling about water. They lacked faith. They didn't believe in what God had explicitly told them that he was going to take care of them. Regardless of the fact that that morning they'd gone out and picked up their daily ration of manna, right? I love the comparison, though, because at the end, when it's a different generation now, getting ready to go into the land, and they're short of water, anybody remember what they did? They sang a song and dug a well. Okay? Why is that different? Was that, oh, well, I can dig this well, and I'll find water myself, and I'm going to be self-reliant? Was that the idea? No, the idea is, if I work for this, what's going to happen? God will take care of it. We'll dig a well and we'll find water because God will take care of us. That was a difference in attitude. The second thing was also with the water, and unfortunately this one had a little worse outcome over in Numbers, the 20th chapter. Remember the second time? What happened there? Yeah, Moses struck the rock, and instead of speaking to the rock like he was supposed to, and it cost him his entrance into the promised land. Now, that's the incident that he's referring to here in this psalm. When he says, they tested me for 40 years. That generation just didn't get it. And so when they, and then there were lots of other things, but those were some specific ones when he goes on down and talks about the waters of Meribah and those kinds of things. But there was also the going into Canaan business, right? And when they came back and said, no, we can't do this. And God was had it by that point. What did he tell them? That's it. You no more. You're not going in. And of course, then they had to all to be surprised, and they were going to go up and do it anyway, which just showed that they had no respect. They had no belief in God. So the problem was that they had been offered rest. And we'll have to talk about rest here in a little bit. But they had been offered rest, but that rest and then obtaining it was contingent on faithful belief in God and what God said. And when they showed that they were not, then God swore and said what? You will not enter my rest. So what was the rest? Was rest meaning don't have to work anymore? Okay. And one of the things that we look at is the whole concept of the Sabbath and its coupling with rest. And we'll see that in a few other places as we go through Hebrews. But we need to really understand the whole concept of God offering a rest or a place of rest. And really the first place that we see it, where's the first mention of a Sabbath rest? The first rest that we read about in the Old Testament. Creation, right? After God created the world, it said that he entered into his rest. Now, I think you have to look at the creation from an interesting standpoint there. When he started out, and it says, in the beginning God made the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, or formless and without form, or void and without form. Lots of translations have slightly different variations there. The reason that that's important is because it's essentially describing the earth as uninhabitable, okay? As it sat, whatever form it was in at that time, could man have lived there? No. So what did God do? He created an environment in which man could live. And that's really the whole purpose if you get down to it, right? I mean, he started out and he's got the waters and he's got the atmosphere and then he's got birds and he's got microbes and he's got fishes and animals and all of that. And what was the last thing that God created during that time? Man. And then he said, I've got it. I'm finished. That was what he aimed at, was creating man. And where did he put man? Okay, Garden of Eden. What's another word that we always talk about when we talk about the Garden of Eden? Paradise. Does that mean that all they had to do was sit around and sip mint juleps all day long? What was their job in the garden? It said they had to tend it and to take care of it. Did they have work they had to do? Sure. But was it God's land of rest for them? Absolutely. So what did that mean? I think he's pointing at the fact that God created this place that we call earth as a home for human beings. We are the ones that were made in God's image, and we were expected to live in fellowship with God. Only what happened? Sin entered the world, we messed up, and what was the result of sin entering in and corrupting that relationship, that fellowship between God and man? Okay. The death was one of the things, but the other one was they got kicked out of the garden, right? Sorry, no more rest for you guys. And in fact, what was he said, from now on, what are you going to do? By the sweat of your brow, things are you're going to have to be working. No rest for you guys. So then we don't see that again until Moses comes out. And what's he offering there? He says, I'll give you a land of rest. And he's got great terms talking about it, right? A land of rest. A land flowing with milk and honey. And he said there that they were going to have things that they didn't work for, they didn't deserve. Right? They're going to have vineyards they didn't plant, and they're going to have cisterns that they didn't dig, and they're going to have olive trees and groves that they didn't do, all of which are long-term investments. And did that mean that when they crossed into the land, they got to sit down and go, woohoo, we're here, it's time for rest. They had to work pretty hard taking the land to begin with, right? But then they got to a point, and Joshua said that the Lord had given them rest. Now, even after that, they still had to go fight some battles and throw some people out of areas and whatnot, but they had the land. They'd been given this opportunity to have a place, and there's something very specific there. I want you to look over in Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter. Deuteronomy 12. Go ahead. Go right ahead. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, in Isaiah, he even talks about God creating Israel. There's a parallel here, and we're going to see why that's important here in just a second, between this creation of the land of Israel and the original creation with man in the garden. There's a lot of parallels there, even in the way that it's talked about under the old law. But look in Deuteronomy 12, in verse 1 he says, "These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on the earth." So, and then he's going to list a bunch of things, but I want you to jump down to verse 8. "You shall not do at all what we are doing here today, where every man is doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For you have not as yet come to the resting place and the inheritance which the Lord your God has given you. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around so that you live in security, then it shall come about that the place in which the Lord your God shall choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and the contribution of your hand and all your choice votive offerings which you will vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and daughters, your male and female servants and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance with you." Now notice there, he says, I'm going to bring you to this place and I'm going to give you rest. And what's your obligation when you get there? Worship and serve your God. You set up this tabernacle that you've been carrying around with you in the place that I'm going to show you, and you serve me. The rest was so that they would have a time and an opportunity to be in fellowship with God. That's what they were being offered. That's what was offered Adam and Eve. And they missed it. That's what was offered to the Israelites. And we know from history what happened there. Kind of missed it. In fact, if you go to the 2 Chronicles, the very last couple of verses in 2 Chronicles, it's kind of an interesting passage there, because it says that they had sinned and God had hauled them off into captivity and the land had its Sabbath rest until seven Sabbaths had been completed. So this rest was something of the establishing of the relationship between God and man. And what he's talking about over here in Hebrews 3, notice then, that group didn't make it. And the reason they didn't make it was the same reason that Adam and Eve didn't make it, and all along the line the people didn't make it, is because it says in verse 12, "Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil and unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God." Now, I've got a question for you. If it's impossible, once you've been saved by God, to fall away, why is this verse here? Why is half of Hebrews here? Exactly. We could go to the whole book of Hebrews, really. But this verse is just so plain. Those people had it offered to them. They had it handed to them. Not just on a silver spoon that, oh, you know, nothing to do. There were obligations on their part. But if they weren't going to keep their obligations, then God says the reason would be because they had an unbelieving heart.
There are so many conditional statements in Hebrews. You already pointed out.
Yeah. People can miss it.
And these scriptures and say, well, I mean, I have read, you know, people who hold to the once saved, always saved doctrine, and they will say that these scriptures, like the one we're looking at right here, chapter 3, that they're presenting a really an impossible scenario. And like you're saying,
what's the point? What's the point?
If these Christians, and there's no doubt these are right Christians.
Oh, no doubt. And is there any doubt that he's taking these verses from Psalms and applying it to them? He's not saying, oh, look, in the past there was this problem, but oh, we don't have that today. He's saying, just like they had a problem, we have to be careful that we don't have the same problem. And the next verse, he gives the cure for that problem. What does it say? But encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. One of the reasons I talked a lot about the Sabbath and about the rest that they were offered is that sometimes I think there's a misconception that people have about the Lord's Day, Sunday. Is the Lord's Day our current sort of Sabbath? No, it's not. They're not even close to equal. They're not even in the same league. Sabbath was their day of rest. But now, Jesus really taught them and helped them understand what that really meant, right? He did a lot of things on the Sabbath day that those people just weren't used to. Anybody remember some of the things that happened? Yeah, he healed people. His disciples had been out all night working with some people, and through their when they were coming back, they picked some grains. And they were accused of breaking the Sabbath day. One of my favorite verses, take a look over in Luke, the 13th chapter. And we'll get to why I think this is important in a minute, hopefully. Yeah, Luke 13. There's several instances here, but in beginning in verse 10, he's teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. Now, this occurs so often, the miracles on the Sabbath day, that there's no way it was accidental. And listen to what happens here. Behold, there was a woman who for 18 years had had a sickness caused by a spirit, and she was bent double and could not straighten up at all. And when Jesus saw her, he called her over and said to her, "Woman, you are freed from your sickness." And he laid his hands upon her, and immediately she was made erect again and began glorifying God. And the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the multitude in response, "There are 6 days in which work should be done, and therefore come during them and get healed, and not on the Sabbath day." Now think about that. This guy thinks he understands the Sabbath, right? And he's standing up and he said, "Shame on you for coming to be healed on the Sabbath. There's 6 other days of the week to do that kind of thing, and we're not going to have that kind of stuff in my synagogue on the Sabbath." Sounds a little bit on the pompous side, doesn't he? But you picked the wrong person to tangle with here, because Jesus comes right back and says, "But the Lord answered him and said, 'You hypocrites! Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? And this woman, a daughter of Abraham as she is, whom Satan had bound for 18 years, Should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day? Why was releasing her from that bond on the Sabbath significant? It was rest. It was fellowship with God. It was demonstrating God's power over the evil one. It was highly appropriate for the Sabbath. The Sabbath didn't mean no work. Jesus, when he was talked about the eating the grain, one of the things he said was, don't you know that the priests break the Sabbath every day, every time? Why? What were they doing? Offering sacrifices. And in fact, there were already morning and evening sacrifices every day, right? But the Sabbath had extra ones. So on this day of rest, they had extra sacrifices. Why? Because it was the day of fellowship with God. So, if the Sabbath was the day of fellowship with God, and that's what they were not going to be entering into when they disobeyed God here, in the Christian age, who's our last hope of entering into a fellowship relationship with God? Who's the last hope? Jesus. And isn't that what he offers, is a relationship with God? And that one, I think there's echoes all through the New Testament about it's not just a Sabbath day relationship. What kind of relationship does it evolve into as a Christian in our fellowship and our relationship with God? Is it just on Sundays? When? It's every day. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. What is that? But rest, believing in the promise that God will take care of us, and we do that every day. Encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I love that phrase today, and he's going to hit on that multiple times here. It does have a piece of hearkening back to the Messianic age. But it also has this sense of immediacy, right? Right now. It's not tomorrow. You ever seen the sign where it says free food tomorrow? If you come back the next day, do you get free food? Why? Because the sign says, still says tomorrow, right? This one says today, right now. You can't put this off. You can't decide later, because these folks blew it. And if you don't listen up and encourage one another every day, you're going to miss it. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. Same phrase again. You see that? If we hold fast. And he emphasizes that over and over again. They've got to hang in there. Wasn't that really what God was asking them to do in the wilderness when they were there? Was hang in there? That next generation coming up, I mean, think about people like Joshua and Caleb. They went into the land and said, yeah, let's go do it. We'll remain faithful to God. And when everybody else didn't, and God said, all right, they're all going to die, and you're going to have to wait 40 years for this, what could have been their response? Oh, man. Hey, that's not our fault. We said what was right. We're ready to go now. Why don't you just carve out a little group and go ahead and send us over? We'll take it. Right? We want this land to rest. Now, what did they have to do for 40 years? They had to put up with the whole rest of everybody else, right? And still keep on, and still hang in there, and still encourage each other every day, knowing that there was an end coming. Well, that's the same thing he calls on us to do. Day after day to do this encouragement. While it is said today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they should not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? And so we see that they were not able to enter the rest because of unbelief. Now, what's the application to these folks here? Well, they're having trouble. We looked at in first class about the fact that they were undergoing persecution. They're questioning whether they're doing the right thing. They're wondering if it's worth all of this. And he's got this piece here where he says, is the rest always easy? Does rest equal no work? Does rest equal no problems? No, you can look back in your Jewish history and understand that rest is putting your faith and trust in God, establishing a relationship with Him, and believing that He will take care of you. And in that belief, our obligation then is to hold fast, which means to do what He says. Okay, that's the implied obligation there. And if we do that, then God takes care of us. Now, did it apply any less to that group of Christians who were having their problems than it did the group coming out of Egypt? Did it apply any less than to Adam and Eve when they were in the garden? You see, that's the same thing God's always wanted. That obligation that if we want to be in fellowship with Him, that we have to put our faith and trust in Him has always been there. You have to. Now, when do you start? Well, he says, today, if you hear His voice, right? What does he mean by hear His voice? Is hear His voice just, oh, the voice of one crying in the wilderness. I thought I heard something. We had a little one with us this week, right? And there were times when he was up in his crib asleep, and we would go, oh, I hear the voice. Could we understand what he was saying? Actually, we could. Come get me out of here. But he wasn't verbalizing that, right? Yeah. Hearing is more than just the noise coming in your ear. It's hearing and understanding. If you hear His voice. Now, the interesting part of that is, God's not made it difficult. He hasn't fixed it where it's hard to hear His voice. When Adam and Eve were in the garden, were their instructions clear enough for them to obey? Absolutely. So why didn't they? Well, I'll never know, right? Simple word, and it says right here, unbelief. They didn't believe strongly enough in what God had told them. They allowed Satan to deflect them from that goal, right? So, were the instructions clear enough that God gave the Israelites? When He gave them the commandment, He said, these laws are not too hard for you. You can understand them. You can keep them. Now, how do we know that was possible? Jesus did it. Okay? He kept them. He kept the law. He understood the law. Exactly.
And if we follow in His footsteps, and like I said, Jesus said that we can do it, we are partakers with Him on the right way.
And that is the tie, is it not, to the beginning of the chapter. What was the quality that He assigned to both Moses and to Jesus? Faithfulness. They were faithful. The rest of the folks weren't so faithful. And the encouragement is, today if you hear His voice, then it's not too late. You encourage one another. We help each other get through whatever the times are, whatever the threats are to our belief, whatever the threats are to us not following God, whatever they are. The reason we are God's house is to encourage one another and to help get through that. That's the purpose. And that's what he's telling these folks. Look, you're your own help. encourage one another, get through it, because if you remain faithful to the end, what is it that you get? Rest. And so I think there's a sense in which we get rest as part of becoming part of God's family. But that's not the final rest, is it? There's still that hope of the final rest that we'll have with God. And that's the hope that he's also holding out here. So there's two things keep in mind. We can have rest now in the sense of a faithful relationship with God, putting our faith and trust in God and letting him take care of a lot of the problems, and we can encourage each other. And if we hold firm until the end, then what do we get? The rest with God. And that's what he's encouraging these folks to do. Okay, I think we're out of time. That's chapter 3. So we'll pick up with chapter 4 next week.